Today is Tuesday, December 14th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. restates security commitment to Indonesia as China accuses Washington of, quote, incitement, unquote.
We have a strong commitment to the strategic partnership with Indonesia and a strong commitment to our engagement across the Indo-Pacific as an Indo-Pacific nation ourselves.
Plus, the Taliban pledges to improve education and job opportunities for women and girls.
Conditions have really worsened and they are deteriorating by the hour, I would say. Like, we know that today the Afghan currency lost almost 12% within hours.
Also, the UN holds a special session Friday to discuss the, quote, grave human rights situation, unquote, in Ethiopia. Our top story today is in Indonesia. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken reiterated on Tuesday a strong U.S. commitment to a strategic partnership with Indonesia, vowing to, quote, deepen, unquote, maritime cooperation with Southeast Asia's most populous country. Blinken made the remarks after a meeting with Indonesian counterpart Retno Marsudi and the signing of several joint agreements. During his trip to the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, Blinken described the Indo-Pacific as the world's most dynamic region and said everyone had a stake in ensuring a status quo that was without coercion and intimidation in a barely veiled reference to China. Blinken is making his first visit to Southeast Asia since President Joe Biden took office in January, a trip aimed at shoring up relations after a period of uncertainty about U.S. commitment to Asia under the administration of Donald Trump.
We have a strong commitment to the strategic partnership with Indonesia and a strong commitment to our engagement across the Indo-Pacific as an Indo-Pacific nation ourselves. So we are deepening our cooperation on maritime issues, including maritime security, resource management and fisheries conservation, safety and navigation, economic activity, science and technology. In this region, where so much happens by sea, and particularly so much commerce happens by sea, and at a critical moment when the climate crisis threatens our oceans, our waterways, our coasts, marine life, cooperation on maritime issues is particularly vital, and I would argue more important than ever.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. China's foreign ministry on Tuesday accused the United States of inciting divisions after U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken criticized, quote, Beijing's aggressive actions, unquote, in the Indo-Pacific region. Blinken on Tuesday touted a U.S. strategy to deepen its Asian treaty alliances, offering to boost defense and intelligence work with partners in an Indo-Pacific region increasingly concerned over China's behavior. In response to Blinken's remarks, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said the U.S. should promote cooperation in the region instead of, quote, inciting of division and instigating confrontation, unquote. China claims almost the entire South China Sea as its own, despite overlapping claims from other coastal states and a ruling by an international tribunal that its vast claim had no legal basis. Beijing has rejected the U.S. stance as interference from an outside power that could threaten Asia's stability. President Joe Biden has signed an executive order aimed at easing bureaucratic frustration among Americans seeking a wide swath of federal services, from renewing passports to applying for Social Security retirement benefits. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
President Biden will sign an executive order today aimed at easing bureaucratic frustration among Americans seeking a wide swath of federal services, from renewing passports to applying for Social Security benefits. Americans waste a lot of time with office visits or long phone calls. The executive order is geared toward cutting paperwork and allowing them to access more services online. The White House hopes improving experiences with federal agencies will help renew faith in the government and democracy itself. The president last week urged the U.S. and other nations to show they can work for their people.
Democracy's hard. We all know that.
Similar attempts to make the government more nimble have failed for generations. Bill Clinton famously pledged to reinvent government nearly 30 years ago. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A top Taliban leader says Afghanistan's new rulers are committed in principle to education and jobs for girls and women and have learned lessons from their previous time in power. Foreign Minister Amir Khan Mottaki told Associated Press the Taliban are appealing to the world's, quote, mercy and compassion, unquote, to help millions of Afghans in desperate need. Mottaki says that having a weak Afghan government, quote, is not in the interest of anyone, unquote. The minister acknowledged the world's dismay at limitations on girls' education and on women in the workforce. He says the Taliban are working to improve the situation, but Western nations say the Taliban is not doing enough to fulfill their pledge, and that women and girls are still being denied basic rights, including access to education and jobs. For more, I spoke to VOA's Ayaz Gar.
Conditions have really worsened and they are deteriorating by the hour, I would say. Like, we know that today the Afghan currency lost almost 12% within hours, which means inflation is rampant and the government is bankrupt. Obviously, it has no money because of the international sanctions. So there is going to be sooner or later this unrest within the population, because a large number of Afghans are really threatened with starvation. And if there are no jobs and government employees remain unpaid for a few more months, things would become very difficult for the Taliban. And that's what seems to have prompted their foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, to come out and request the international community, particularly the United States, that they're willing to work with the global community, but they really need assistance to take care of their population. So that clearly shows the pressure that the Taliban have come under. But at the same time, we see there is growing criticism also on the international community for suspending this financial assistance and freezing assets of Afghanistan's central bank in order to punish the Taliban.
The Taliban is pledging once again to improve both jobs and education opportunity for girls and women. But critics and Western nations say there's no evidence on ground to show such a wide-scale change of policy by the Taliban.
Well, obviously, you know, Taliban have repeatedly said, their leaders have been saying that they will not prevent women and girls from seeking education and doing outdoor activities without any restrictions. But so far, these have been statements only, because practically on the ground, we know for sure for fact that schoolgirls in most provinces in Afghanistan have still been confined to their homes. They have not been allowed to return to their education activities. University education has been resumed for women, but millions of girls are still sitting at home and waiting for the directive from the Taliban. When will they be able to join their classes? Whereas school boys have already resumed their activities since September. So this contradiction in public statements of the Taliban that they want to allow girls to seek education, but at the same time, so many months have passed, almost 4 months, and girls have not been allowed to return to the schools in most of the provinces, definitely raises a lot of questions. And there is definitely skepticism in the international community whether they should trust the Taliban and allow financial assistance to Afghanistan if they are not living up to their commitments.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. The United Nations says more than 100 former Afghan National Security Forces and others have been killed since the Taliban took over in August, most at the hands of the hardline Islamist group. Nadar al-Nashif, UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights, said Tuesday that in addition, at least 50 suspected members of a local affiliate of Islamic State known as ISIS Khorasan, an ideological foe of the Taliban, died by hanging and beheading. In a speech to the Human Rights Council, she also said families face, quote, severe poverty and hunger, unquote, this winter, amid reports of child labor, early marriages, unquote, even the sale of children, unquote.
We are also alarmed by continuing reports of extrajudicial killings across the country, despite the general amnesty announced by the Taliban after 15 August. Between August and November, we received credible allegations of more than 100 killings of former Afghan National Security Forces and others associated with the former government, with at least 72 of these killings attributed to the Taliban. In several cases, the bodies were publicly displayed. This has, of course, exacerbated fear among the sizable category of the population. In Nangarhar province alone, there also appears to be a pattern of at least 50 extrajudicial killings of individuals suspected to be members of the ISIL-KP. Brutal methods of killings, including hanging, beheadings, and public display of corpses, have been reported. I am deeply concerned about the continued risk of recruitment of children by the ISIL-KP, as well as by the de facto authorities. With boys increasingly visible among security forces at checkpoints, as bodyguards and in combat roles. Children also continue to comprise nearly all of the civilians killed and injured by unexploded ordnance.
The World Health Organization and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, a leading cancer center in the United States, are planning to provide cancer medication free to children in developing countries suffering from the disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Cancer is a leading cause of death worldwide, killing about 10 million people a year. The World Health Organization estimates 400,000 children globally develop cancer every year, with nearly 100,000 dying. The most common types of childhood cancers include leukemias, brain cancers, lymphomas, and solid tumors. WHO reports nearly 9 in 10 children with cancer live in low- and middle-income countries. Andre Ilbawi heads WHO's cancer division in the Department of Non-Communicable Diseases. He says about 80% of children who have cancer in high-income countries survive. He calls this a major achievement and improvement over the past decades.
But that progress hasn't been achieved for children who are living in low- and middle-income countries, where 30% or less will survive a cancer diagnosis. One of the primary reasons is because of care that is simply not available or accessible, and medicines are a core part of the treatment of childhood cancer.
WHO and St. Jude's Hospital have formed a partnership to change this situation. They've established a platform that will dramatically increase access to childhood cancer medicines around the world. To kickstart this program, St. Jude is making a 6-year investment by contributing $200 million. Ilbawi says the money initially will provide medication at no cost to 12 countries that will take part in a 2-year pilot program. He says the governments will be involved in the care of the children and in selecting the medicines that are needed.
From there, we'll work with country partners to make sure those medicines are delivered safely and effectively to the children in need. Over time, this will increase to 50 countries or more within 6 years. This means that almost every child around the world, particularly those in low- and middle-income countries, will benefit from this platform.
The new platform aims to provide safe and effective cancer medicines to approximately 120,000 children between 2022 and 2027. The health partners say the program will be scaled up to include many more beneficiaries in future years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Officials in Haiti say a truck carrying gasoline has exploded and killed more than 50 people. Reported dozens of others have been injured. Prime Minister Ariel Henry said Tuesday that the explosions late Monday occurred in the northern coastal city of Cap-Haïtien. A passerby said he saw people using buckets to scoop up gasoline from the truck. The Caribbean country is struggling with a severe shortage of fuel and spiraling gas prices. A large study in South Africa says the two-dose Pfizer-BioNTech vaccination provides just 33% of protection against infection by the Omicron coronavirus variant, but 70% protection against hospitalization. The release of the first significant analysis of vaccine effectiveness in the region, where the new variant was discovered, appears to support early indications that Omicron is more easily transmissible and that the Pfizer shot isn't as effective in protecting against infection as it was against the Delta variant. This study was carried out by South Africa's largest private health insurer and the South Africa Medical Research Council. The researchers emphasized that its findings are preliminary and not peer-reviewed. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is in Australia for talks with Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Analysts have said that enhancing defense ties is a priority of the 4-day visit, along with China's growing regional influence. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is the first world leader to arrive since Australia closed its borders to most foreign travellers in March 2020. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison welcomed Moon and South Korea's First Lady Kim Jong-suk to Canberra on Monday.
I'm so pleased we could join together, as we have been threatening to do for many years now through COVID. and we can now come together in this way, and I'm so pleased to be able to host you and to formally elevate our relationship to a comprehensive strategic partnership.
The leaders have agreed on several new joint initiatives around clean energy technology, the supply of critical minerals, and defence. Under a new deal worth $771 million, the South Korean company Hanwha will provide 30 howitzers, ammunition supply vehicles, and radars to detect enemy artillery. It's the largest military contract between Australia and an Asian nation. Analysts have said South Korea is also well placed to win a contract with Australia worth $21.3 billion for new infantry attack vehicles. Speaking through an interpreter, Moon said the two countries were committed to an open, inclusive and prosperous Indo-Pacific region.
Korea and Australia uphold the same values, and our position in terms of the geopolitical situation, we are like-minded. Therefore, Korea is focused on a steadfast alliance with the U.S. and also with China. We want a harmonized relationship.
Moon is the first South Korean president to come to Australia in more than a decade. Haley Channer, a senior policy fellow with the Perth US Asia Centre, says Moon's visit is significant.
Australia's often looked across the table and seen South Korea and seen that it's preoccupied with developments on the Korean Peninsula. But Australia and South Korea have so many different things in common. So having this bilateral visit is extremely important to progress the relationship forward.
This year, the two nations will mark 60 years of diplomatic relations. South Korea is Australia's fourth largest trading partner. A free trade deal has been in place since December 2014. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The Chinese government is promoting Chinese language and culture through Confucius Institute programs worldwide, including in Africa. Some educators say they are concerned about what they say is censorship in Chinese-funded programs. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Steve Wakoli has been working for 3 years to perfect his skills in Kung Fu, a popular martial art taught at the Kenyatta University Confucius Institute. He's also a teacher at the institute, where hundreds of students are learning about Chinese culture and language at the facility named after the ancient Chinese philosopher whose teachings are a cornerstone of life in East Asia. There are about 525 Chinese-funded Confucius Institutes worldwide, including 54 in Africa, according to a 2019 U.S. Senate report by the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Jacob Ratemo is one of more than 500 students enrolled here. He says learning about Chinese language and culture will help him find better work, but Ratemo acknowledges the classes avoid subjects that are politically sensitive in China.
But the advantage is, I think, especially when you're in university level, you can access such matters. You know, I can go to VOA and use it on a regular basis and see what is going on in China, or I can go to Google and get that information. So, yes, I can admit there are a few challenges when you ask those questions to the Chinese themselves.
According to the Senate report, Confucius Institute funding comes with strings that can compromise academic freedom. For example, the Chinese teachers signed contracts with Beijing, pledging not to damage China's national interests. Confucius Institute management turned down VOA's request for comment. Teacher Wakoli says the institute's syllabus does not allow much time for politically sensitive topics and debate. But analysts say the Confucius Institute suppressed discussions on topics like Taiwan and Hong Kong to protect their funding from the Chinese government. Martin Olo is a political analyst in Kenya.
Indeed, there have been issues around whether or not the institute is being used to propound what would be seen as anti-democracy, anti-human rights. And those concerns are founded in terms of what is the official Chinese policy on Taiwan, on Hong Kong.
China considers Taiwan a wayward province and has not ruled out the use of force to reunite it with the mainland. Beijing imposed a national security law for Hong Kong in 2020, and many forms of dissent are criminalized. Educator Jonathan Wesaya told VOA that the institutes are doing injustice to students by limiting their learning and exposure to different ideas.
Yes, the opportunity comes in through the Confucius Institute funded by China. That is okay. But can you get as an individual to talk about Taiwan, talk about Hong Kong, talk about Korea, talk about North Korea and South Korea and how they relate, and how the whole bigger picture fits into the geopolitics of today?
With so many signing up for classes at the Confucius Institute, education experts say it's critical that students find other avenues to learn about topics that Beijing may consider politically sensitive. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Benin has adopted a new law legalizing abortion in most cases, one of the few African countries to do so. A conservative country, the law was passed by parliament to prevent a wave of clandestine abortions that have resulted in the deaths of women. Koam Joel Honore has this report from Cotonou.
5 years ago, Francine became pregnant. A student at the time, she was afraid to tell her parents. She asked VOA not to use her real name and protect her identity.
I couldn't tell my parents because I was still in college, and if they learned of my pregnancy, I was going to stop going to school.
She ended up getting a clandestine abortion, but the procedure went badly and she had to be hospitalized.
When we got here, we were taken to the consultation room. I lay down on a table, and when I took off the filling I was wearing, things were coming out of me. They told me it was my intestines.
There has been an increase of clandestine abortions this year as sexual assaults have risen, says the head gynecologist of Aplahwe City Hospital.
I had to manage 3 cases of clandestine abortions. There is one who died, and there are 2 teenagers, 17 and 18 years old, who are alive, but they no longer have their uteruses.
According to Benin's Ministry of Social Affairs, 200 women die each year as a result of complication. This led the government to introduce a law in October authorizing abortion to stop such death.
Avec le constat qui a été fait,
we really had to react. We have hundreds of women who died in deplorable conditions because they wanted to try to abort under non-secure conditions.
But Benin's clergy and traditional leaders oppose the law as an attack on life.
La vie de l'homme est quelque chose d'important.
The life of a human being is something important and must be considered. The problem is to know in what conditions the woman got pregnant.
But those who have had complications from clandestine abortions says there should be no debate about saving the life of women.
When we get pregnant and don't want to keep it, we have to be helped. Pregnancy prevents us from going to school.
Benin's government is preparing to launch a public awareness campaign in schools and throughout the country about merit of the abortion law. Kwame Joel Honore for VOA News, Cotonou, Benin.
European diplomats are expressing frustrations with Iran's stance in talks aimed at salvaging Iran's 2015 nuclear deal, saying they are wasting, quote, precious time, unquote, dealing with new Iranian demands, and that, quote, time is running out, unquote. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said on Tuesday, diplomacy remains the best option, but that Washington is engaging with partners and alternatives. Talks in Vienna between the remaining signatories to the 2015 agreement resumed last week in Vienna. Diplomats from Britain, France, and Germany had urged Tehran to come back with realistic proposals, unquote, after the Iranian delegation representing the new hardline government previously made demands that other participants deemed unacceptable. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit bonnews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.